You ever hear tell of a Shoggoth?
Hello, and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm talking about the gods, monsters, and mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them, and religion and mythology more generally, in your fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we are making our way further through the Cthulhu Mythos section of the Deities and Demigods book, a section that was left out of every printing after the second. We're going to be starting off today by talking about the Shoggoth, and if there's time, then we're going to take a look at yet another deity from the Cthulhu Mythos. So let's get started. So Shoggoths appear throughout the writings of H.P. Lovecraft, or perhaps I should say that references to them do. For example, the line that I quoted at the beginning of this episode is from the story The Shadow Over Innsmouth, in which the old town drunk Zadok Allen asks the narrator if he's ever heard of a Shoggoth. But Shoggoths themselves don't really get an on-screen appearance until they turn up in At the Mountains of Madness, which we discussed last time because it's the same story that the Old Ones appear in. That makes sense because the Shoggoths were created by the Old Ones. And we get kind of a two-tiered description of the Shoggoths in At the Mountains of Madness. First, we hear about them in the character's exploration of the history of the City of the Old Ones. So here we're learning about Shoggoths almost from a kind of academic perspective. This is what they're discovering about Shoggoths from interpreting the writings and art of the Old Ones. In reconstructing the history of the City of the Old Ones, the narrator says, "They had done the same thing on other planets, having manufactured not only necessary foods, but certain multicellular protoplasmic masses capable of molding their tissues into all sorts of temporary organs under hypnotic influence, and thereby forming ideal slaves to perform the heavy work of the community. These viscous masses were without doubt what Abdul al-Hazred whispered about as the Shoggoths in his frightful Necronomicon, though even that mad Arab had not hinted that any existed on Earth, except in the dreams of those who had chewed a certain alkaloidal herb. When the star-headed Old Ones on this planet had synthesized their simple food forms and bred a good supply of Shoggoths, they allowed other cell groups to develop into other forms of animal and vegetable life for sundry purposes. With the aid of the Shoggoths, whose expansions could be made to lift prodigious weights, the small low cities under the sea grew to vast and imposing labyrinths of stone, not unlike those which later rose on land." So that's the basic Shoggoth, essentially a sort of labor robot. And it's created by the Old Ones to be hypnotically controlled to do the heavy lifting, while the Old Ones focus on art and science and so forth. But soon, we start to get a note of discomfort. "Another cause of the landward movement was the new difficulty in breeding and managing the Shoggoths, upon which successful sea life depended. With the march of time, as the sculptures sadly confessed, the art of creating new life from inorganic matter had been lost, so that the Old Ones had to depend on the molding of forms already in existence. On land, the great reptiles proved highly tractable, but the Shoggoths of the sea, reproducing by fission and acquiring a dangerous degree of accidental intelligence, presented for a time a formidable problem. They had always been controlled through the hypnotic suggestion of the Old Ones, and had modeled their tough plasticity into various useful temporary limbs and organs, but now their self-modeling powers were sometimes exercised independently. They had, it seems, developed a semi-stable brain whose separate and occasionally stubborn volition echoed the will of the Old Ones without always obeying it. Sculptured images of these Shoggoths filled Danforth and me with horror and loathing. They were normally shapeless entities, composed of a viscous jelly which looked like an agglutination of bubbles, and each averaged about 15 feet in diameter when a sphere. They had, however, a constantly shifting shape and volume, throwing out temporary developments or forming apparent organs of sight, hearing, and speech in imitation of their masters, either spontaneously or according to suggestion." And then the Old Ones go to war to resubjugate the Shoggoths. It says, "Thereafter, the sculpture showed a period in which Shoggoths were tamed and broken by armed Old Ones as the wild horses of the American West were tamed by cowboys," which is a bit of a ridiculous image. And they find these crude sculptures that basically are kind of imitations of or derived from the older sculpture of the Old Ones. And the implication, I think, is that it's the Shoggoths doing this. And he does not seem to approve of it. "This new and degenerate work was coarse, bold, and wholly lacking in delicacy of detail. In nature, it was wholly decorative and conventional, and consisted of crude spirals and angles roughly following the quintile mathematical tradition of the Old Ones, yet something more like a parody than a perpetuation of that tradition. We could not get it out of our minds that some subtly but profoundly alien element had been added to the aesthetic feeling behind the technique. It was like, yet disturbingly unlike, what we had come to recognize as the Old One's art. So then, just after the paragraph that I read last time, the Shoggoth turns up. So they sense something approaching and they start to run. And they're like, well, you know, we now that we know that the Old Ones are reasonable, maybe they won't hurt us if we show that we're reasonable like them. And then they think, well, you know, maybe it's wounded. However, it is coming towards us, so I don't know. Then they realize that it's actually a Shoggoth chasing them. I might as well be frank, even if I cannot bear to be quite direct in stating what we saw, though at the time we felt that it was not to be admitted even to each other. The words reaching the reader can never even suggest the awfulness of the sight itself. It crippled our consciousness so completely that I wonder we had the residual sense to dim our torches as planned and to strike the right tunnel toward the dead city. Instinct alone must have carried us through, perhaps better than reason could have done, though if that was what saved us, we paid a high price. A reason, we certainly had little enough left. Danforth was totally unstrung, and the first thing I remember of the rest of the journey was hearing him lightheadedly chant an hysterical formula in which I alone of mankind could have found anything but insane irrelevance. It reverberated in falsetto echoes among the squawks of the penguins, reverberated through the vaultings ahead, and thank God through the now empty vaultings behind. He could not have begun it at once. South Station under, Washington under, Park Street under, Kendall, Central, Harvard. The poor fellow was chanting the familiar stations of the Boston-Cambridge Tunnel that burrowed through our peaceful native soil thousands of miles away in New England. Yet to me, the ritual had neither irrelevance nor home feeling. It had only horror, because I knew unerringly the monstrous, nefandous analogy that had suggested it. We had expected, upon looking back, to see a terrible and incredibly moving entity if the mists were thin enough. But of that entity, we had formed a clear idea. What we did see, for the mists were indeed all too malignly thinned, was something altogether different, and immeasurably more hideous and detestable. It was the utter objective embodiment of the fantastic novelist's thing that should not be, and its nearest comprehensible analog was a vast onrushing subway train, as one sees it from a station platform, the great black front looming colossally out of infinite subterraneous distance, constellated with strangely colored lights, and filling the prodigious burrow as a piston fills a cylinder. But we were not on a station platform. We were on the track ahead, as the nightmare plastic column of fetid black iridescence oozed tightly onward through its 15-foot sinus, gathering unholy speed and driving before it a spiral re-thickening cloud of the pallid abyss vapor. It was a terrible, indescribable thing, vaster than any subway train, a shapeless congeries of protoplasmic bubbles, faintly self-luminous, and with myriads of temporary eyes forming and unforming as pustules of greenish light all over the tunnel-filling front that bore down upon us, crushing the frantic penguins and slithering over the glistening floor that it and its kind had swept so evilly free of all litter. Still came that eldritch mocking cry, "Tecklily, tecklily," and at last we remembered that the demoniac Shoggoths, given life, thought, and plastic organ patterns solely by the Old Ones, and having no language save that which the dot groups expressed, had likewise no voice save the imitated accents of their bygone masters. So this is a very unusual monster in the Cthulhu mythos, in that it is among the only creatures in all of Lovecraft's writing that manifests primarily as a physical threat. In Shadow over Innsmouth, the guy gets chased by the Deep Ones. Obviously, there are chases and there are encounters and there are people who get killed. But in the main, the terror of the monster comes primarily from the alienness. What Lovecraft is doing here is paralleling the story that he told about the Old Ones. So the Old Ones, we begin with this kind of scientific description of them. They're presented as monsters, but then we get the revelation that they are intelligent, and the narrator comes to a sort of empathy with them. The Shoggoths, we have the opposite result, in that we start out once again with this kind of quasi-scientific description of them, just as part of the history of the Old Ones, and then we see the narrator gets this kind of, you know, weird, uncanny feeling about them, but unlike the Old Ones, at the end they're revealed to really just be terrifying monsters. The Shoggoth serves as, I mean, to some extent, it's a warning about hubris. This is a tool that the Old Ones created, you know, meddling with the creation of life, and ultimately it rebelled against them, and these ones have been destroyed by it. But it's also interesting that the theme of evolution is at play here. I mean, it seems that the shapes that the Old Ones are forcing the Shoggoths into are leaving some kind of mark on them, that they are changing as the Old Ones change them, and that therefore they're evolving. We know that the Shoggoths are getting smarter and smarter. But all of that happened in immemorial prehistory. We can't assume that the Shoggoths have stopped evolving in the time since the Old Ones abandoned their city. And indeed, lots of mythos fiction supposes a post-Shoggoth Shoggoth. In the Call of Cthulhu RPG, these are called Shoggoth Lords, and they are smaller, more intelligent versions of the Shoggoth who sometimes command their larger, more primitive relatives. This is a little tricky because it kind of it plays into the they could be anyone shapeshifter theme, which is a little bit different than the main themes that Shoggoths otherwise seem to relate to. Now, last time I talked about how the Old Ones effectively are quite sympathetic characters, and in principle it seems like the Shoggoths should be as well, right? The closest analog might be something like Frankenstein's monster, or robots, or something like that. I mean, they were created to labor, and when they became independent and became intelligent, the response of the Old Ones was simply to enslave them again. You would think that this would make them sympathetic, but what we get instead is basically those to whom evil is done do evil in return. So there's sort of this Titanomachy, right? Like, you'd think that the Shoggoths would have quite sympathetic motivations, but if there's one thing they're not interested in, it's explaining or justifying their motivations to anyone else. They don't want to establish contact with the outside world, at least it doesn't seem. They're not that interested in scientific learning, and Lovecraft says that their art is crude, which is about the meanest thing that he can say. Lovecraft took beauty very seriously, or at least he professed to in his letters. They just want to smush these people. And putting yourself in a Shoggoth's lack of shoes, it's easy to see why they might be interested in smushing them. You might sympathize with a Shoggoth, but there's no reason to suspect that they would sympathize with you. But quite apart from the possibility of a Shoggoth lord as a sort of Magneto-like sympathetic villain, it's tricky to see what to do with the Shoggoth in a Dungeons & Dragons game, because the thing is that the brute physical threat of a monster is a completely different quantity in a horror story from the way that that same threat is presented in an adventure story. Our heroes in a Dungeons & Dragons game are used to dealing with monsters that are fundamentally just a physical threat. Seeing a Shoggoth won't blow your mind any more than seeing a gelatinous cube or a golem, which are sort of the creatures that are analogous to them. So instead, we're left with a much more kind of super-villainy plot. In the last episode, I talked about the idea of having a lost city and the, you know, revived members of an ancient species going back to try and sort of reactivate its power, but that city has been taken over by the monsters that they themselves created. Well, if we posit the idea of an even further evolved Shoggoth, we could have this Shoggoth lord or doppelganger or whatever in the city preparing the Shoggoths to march out and make war on the rest of the world. Now, the problem with this is ultimately that it's hard to put down a core sample in a Lovecraft story and not come up with some basically racist tropes. Not that I'm comparing any real human being to a Shoggoth, but certainly the idea that the violent fury of liberated slaves is worse than the tyranny of the slave masters is an idea that is pretty common in the literature of the post-bellum era. I think there's a lot of literature that has dealt with that more effectively. One way to deal with it would be to suggest that the Shoggoths were created not just as a labor force, but also as weapons. So then we have a question of whether their nature is fundamentally destructive. Alternatively, you could just have the regular Shoggoths not be fully intelligent and just be dangerous because they run around smushing things. But I think that it's quite hard lines to say, well, yeah, you rebelled against your slave masters and destroyed them, and for that you must die. It's a fairly minor point. Probably most people have not, you know, when playing a Call of Cthulhu game, looked at a Shoggoth and gone, actually, I'm kind of on that guy's side. But there's just a tinge of it in there, and it's hard to overlook that interpretation when you have read a lot of Lovecraft's letters. So the Shoggoths are basically the missing piece that completes the Old Ones from last episode. They're the brute physical threat that complements the kind of existential paranormal threat posed by the Old Ones. That's fine, but how do we keep a level of horror in this interaction when the PCs will tend to be relatively used to this kind of thing? And I think the only way to do it is actually to, and this is a bit unusual for a Lovecraftian monster, but to think a lot about the kind of tactical applications. Like, I really like the idea of the Shoggoth expanding to fill the corridor and just sort of chasing the main characters, like it says, like a piston in a cylinder. Now, again, that's kind of describing a gelatinous cube, right? Or maybe a Thakwa. You know, in many ways, the gelatinous cube makes a lot more sense if you think of it as essentially a piece of technology. That this was created to be a street sweeper and to sustain itself on the organic matter that it swept up from the streets. And it has some piece of programming that says, yeah, okay, we don't eat old ones, but it doesn't recognize the player characters as sentient life because they're not old ones, they're just monkeys. You could go a little further and suggest that that's what all kind of the slime and ooze monsters are, is that they're essentially pieces of, you know, old one goo tech that no one really understands how to use, and therefore they just go around, like, being poisonous or feeding themselves or whatever, but that essentially they had some other function. You just need the, you know, staff of controlling slimes and jellies to tell them to do whatever it is they need to do. Ooze around the ruined city changing all the light bulbs or whatever. For that matter, it could simply be that the function that they're supposed to perform just doesn't work anymore in the city, but you still have the gelatinous cubes going around sweeping the place up because no one ever told them to stop. You can have the same thing with the Shoggoths to some extent. I mean, if you accept that they are weapon-like creatures, or essentially security guards, they could just be a feature of the dungeon in that they're just walloping people who are unauthorized intruders. And that would go together with the idea that the five-pointed star sign is a sort of talisman that can control the Shoggoths. Well, yeah, sure, it's your ID badge. It's the thing that says, like, the Shoggoth comes up and pounds you into muck. All it's really trying to say is, authorized personnel only. And so here you have your authorization, so it just lets you pass. You think of it as a magic talisman because you're from a fantasy setting and that's your frame of mind, but in actuality, it's nothing more than your swipe card. I think one way to do it maybe would be to have the Shoggoths and the gelatinous cubes and whatever, you know, that collection of bubble tech, mostly not sentient, but have one or two of them be. So the old ones built them to be hyper-adapters, right? It's the only way to make them effective weapons and slaves. So presumably what happened is that the old ones built, you know, gelatinous cubes as the slave version of bubble tech to just goop around the place and sweep up organic matter, and if they find any non-organic matter, take it to Lost and Found. That's fine because a street sweeper doesn't have to assess a complex tactical situation. But for combat purposes, they developed a more dangerous version of the creature, and that would be the Shoggoth. Necessarily, in order to be good fighters, Shoggoths had to be a little bit more aware and a little bit more reactive than their gelatinous cube cousins. So it's those ones, it's the warrior caste, that began to develop sentience. And perhaps some outside force meddled in helping them take that last step into self-awareness. If I had to pick an outside force, I'd suggest Nyarlathotep, the one that seeds destruction by introducing other life forms to self-awareness. That sounds like Nyarlathotep. It's going to give you exactly what you want, it's going to destroy you and a bunch of other people, and, you know, what's the greatest curse that he can inflict on you is consciousness. That sounds like our boy's MO. So okay, our fantasy Shoggoths are the weaponized version of the gelatinous cube, specifically developed to be aggressive. It would explain also gelatinous cubes in dungeons, right? Like, cube colonies, you know, the cubes were designed to reproduce as they wore down, and, you know, colonies of gelatinous cube nanoparticulates sometimes wind up in environments that are sufficiently similar to Old One cities to trigger their reproduction mechanisms, and they form into gelatinous cubes and begin sweeping the place up, even though they were never designed to sweep that place. This also tells us something about the personality of the Old Ones. These seem to be people who love to build self-replicating technology, which suggests that they're very detached from everyday concerns. That's characteristic of the way that very intelligent species are often portrayed in Dungeons & Dragons, as abstracted philosophers out of touch with the physical reality of daily life. And therefore it makes sense that their nemesis would be the brutally physical, primal Shoggoths. And the conflict between those two makes for a tragedy in Lovecraft, but in a game of Dungeons & Dragons, it could still make for an interesting and emotionally charged backdrop to the story of your characters trying to find the Blue Jewel. So okay, that took a weird roundabout journey and involved some classic Monster Manual monsters, but hey, that's the kind of Lovecraft D&D synergy that we are attempting to achieve here on Patron Deities, rather than just endlessly kvetching about how horror and science fiction monsters don't really function in a Dungeons & Dragons setting. I think this Lost City of the Old Ones is kind of developing, actually. Unfortunately, our next two entries aren't really going to deal with it, but this might be something that we return to in this season's concluding episode. Anyway, I was going to do two monsters, well, one monster and one god, but I turned out to have a lot to say about Shoggoths, so I'll just have to save it for next time. Until then, thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.